Three black bones came lolling out of it. After that, the Major didn't stop moving and mouthing, panting and gasping until he was back through the wormhole to the white glaring core, where finally, at the foot of the ladder, he paused, removed his mask and threw up. Having followed him, Luchov stood off at a safe distance and watched, and as the young Major finished but continued to kneel there, hanging like a limp rag on the lower rungs, so the project director said,
"So now you begin to understand? You understand something of the horror this place has seen, inherent in its atmosphere, indeed in its walls? Down here, sealed in by the magmas, and in other places, bricked up by men who couldn't bear to contemplate it, there is much horror. Ah, but up there," he lifted his eyes to the belly of the steel disc with his overlapping plates, "on the other side of that madly glaring Cyclops gate, there is so much more, an entire world of horror for all we know, which is still alive."
The Major wiped his mouth.
"I could see it in your eyes that you thought I'd cracked," Luchov told him. "Well, of course I have. Do you really think I'd be here if I was entirely sane?"
The Major coughed into his hand and mumbled,
"My God! My God!"
Luchov nodded and without malice said,
"Nice thought. But what has he to do with this place, eh?"
He shook his head.
"Very little, I fear. And the longer you're here, the more godless it gets to be."
Not even attempting to answer, the other continued to cling tightly to the ladder's rungs. Below the caldera of an ancient volcano, in a place not unlike subterranean Perchosk, and yet an entire universe away, a place of wormhole lava runs and sulfur walls, where ages ago superheated gas had expanded to form caverns like bubbles in chocolate, and the liquid guts of a planet had first forced and then made permanent a spiderweb network of channels in the permeable rock, this was where the monstrous Lord Shaitan had made his home in a time immemorial. And here, just 4 years ago, his descendant Scythus of the Vampiri had discovered him alive and plotting still. Now, standing tall but dramatically insignificant against the dark uppermost fangs of the caldera's broken walls, like a statue there on the old cone's lava rim under writhing auroral vaults shot through with the occasional scars of a meteorite suicide, and gazing south upon a far faint horizon, Scythus selected and highlighted memories of those years, of how they'd passed, of how what he'd seen and learned and of what had been planned by his ancestor Shaitan and himself. Plans which purported to coincide, though not necessarily. Indeed, not at all. And guarding such thoughts, but jealously, fearfully, Scythus remembered his journey here from Starside, on the rim, across surly iceberg oceans and vast wintry wastelands, he and the other survivors of the Dweller's Wrath, the giant Fess, hideous Vulse, squat Arcus, and various thralls, all fled here, self-exiled, under threat of a vampire's death, which is far more terrible than that of any mere man, and not alone from an entirely physical point of view. For a man knows he must die, but a vampire knows he need not. 4 years ago, after the Welky Vulse's loathsome demise, Scythus, in his treachery, had directed Arcus Leperson, called Dire Death, and the acromegalic Fess Varenk into the clutches of Shaitan the Unborn, where, in the shrieking sulphur shadows of an ancient lava run, the immemorial monster had struck out of his own mind silence. Even now, remembering how it had been, Scythus gave an unaccustomed start. The lightning-swift, shadow-silent attack of the siphon snout, as Scythus thought of such creatures now, then Arcus speared and held aloft on nimbly skipping tiptoes, jerking and throbbing on the hollow bone blade where it pierced him to the heart, eyes bulging and cheeks going in and out like a bellow, puffing out a fine damp scarlet mist. Extremely fine, that life mist, for Shaitan's inaugurator had been loath to lose or spill a drop. And Fess, the giant, rounding on Scythus in a fury, all intent upon tearing out his heart. But Shaitan to the rescue, flowing out of the darkness like a tide of evil, wrapping the berserker in a nest of tentacles, while Scyther swung his gauntlet to burst his head in. And the one final scene which remained fresh as steaming blood in Scyther's mind to this day. The great pulsing mass of the Ferengi held fast for long and long in Shaitan's many-armed embrace, until at last the giant's throbbing ceased and the elastic cobra jaws relaxed his head, leaving it wet and smoking and apparently whole, except it was seen how the eye sockets were empty and trickling, with similar dribbling escaping from the nostrils and slack yawning mouth. And Scyther's thinking a thought so cold it burned him still. Oh yes, surely Hell's Gate, where I have just witnessed a so-called ancestor of mine, emptying the Ferengi's head like a rat sucking out a stolen egg. And
indeed you have,
Shaitan had at once gurglingly agreed, while his crimson eyes in their yellow orbits glared out from the darkness beneath the black, corrugated flesh of his cobra's hood.
My creature siphoned off his blood for safekeeping until later, you understand, and I sucked out his brains. But you'll note how we left the best for you, eh?
With which he made a small effort to propel the corpse in Scyther's direction, so that it had appeared to take two stumbling, flopping steps towards him before crashing at his feet. And of course, he'd known exactly what the other meant, for hiding in the Ferengi's huge, pale, dehydrated shell, his vampire, ah, sweetmeat of sweetmeats, was still to be discovered and reckoned with. And,
won't you join me?
Shaitan had offered a clotted, gurgled invitation before wrenching Arcus from the bubbling blade of the ingurgitator and throwing him down to the lava floor, there falling or flowing over him as he commenced a search for his frantic, cringing parasite. To this point, events had left Scyther somewhat stunned, but not for much longer. He was, after all, Vampiri, and all of this had been much as anticipated. And of course, the blood was the life. Dining with Shaitan may even have sealed something of a bond between them. It might have, anyway. After that, there was a lot to remember, and events contrived to jumble. A good many fractured scenes and conversations overlapped their jagged edges in Scyther's memory. As contrary breezes blew off the cold blue star, an auroral litten waste, bringing nodding snow devils to swirl around the bases of the glittering, plundered ice castle tombs of the anciently exiled Vampiri, so he attempted to arrange these fragments in chronological order, or failing that, to separate them at least. Shaitan's cavernous workshop, for example, located immediately beneath the volcano's hitherto unseen north-facing scarp, where soon after Scyther's advent, the Fallen One had escorted him upon a guided tour. Apart from the high-ceilinged, stalactite-adorned vastness of the place, with its near-opaque windows of ice looking out upon and lending grotesque distortions to the very roof of the world and its deep permafrost pits, where Shaitan was wont to confine in ice his more volatile, less manageable experiments, the workshop had seemed much like any other. Scyther, too, was a master of just such creative metamorphism, or so he had always considered himself, until he saw his ancestors' work. Gazing down on one such piece through ice clear as water, he had offered his opinion.
This alone would suffice to have you denounced and banished afresh, or destroyed outright if this were Starside and the old Vampiri still held sway. Why, it has reproductive organs which were forbidden.
A bull-eye! Shaitan had answered with a nod of his cowl. Alas, but procreation, the act of copulation, its contemplation, even the possession of organs of the means, drives creatures to rage. I made this one a mate, female, which, for thanks, he at once tore to pieces. But even if she'd lived and brought forth, what then? I cannot see that he'd permit offspring to survive, but would surely devour them at the first opportunity. Just look at him.
and as yet half-grown. And so, untrustworthily, at last I was obliged to freeze him here. The fault was his sex. It made him prideful, and pride is a curse. It's the same with men, of course.
And therefore with the Vampiri,
Scythus had said.
More so, Scheiton cried, for in them all such urges are amplified by 10.
But they don't tear their odalisks in pieces, at least not always.
More fool them, said Scheiton. For if you can do forever, what sense to breed that of your own flesh which may one day usurp and destroy you?
And yet you sought out women in which to spend yourself,
Scythus had been quick to point out.
Else I'd not be here.
And at that their eyes had met and locked across Shaitan's creature frozen in its pit of ice, and after a while the fallen one had answered,
I did, it's true, and perhaps for that very reason.
It had been their first argument or discussion as such, but only one of a great many to come. And while it would soon become Scythus's complaint that his ancestor conversed with him in terms more befitting a child, generally he accepted that the ancient evil being was trying to instruct him. Perhaps he considered his great age gave him the right, for after all, he was Scythus's senior to the extent of 7 spans. Another time, Scythus had been shown a developing siphon snout, absorbing liquids where it gradually took on a shape and substance in a vat. The thing was much similar to the guardian ingurgitators, of which the volcano's master had 3, but the siphon was longer, more flexible, and bended at its roots in great walls of flesh, so that the creature's tiny, greedily glinting eyes were almost entirely hidden in bulging bands of grey, gleaming muscle. Scythus had known immediately what the thing was, inquiring of Scheiton,
"But don't you have enough of these? It surprises me you trouble yourself to make more. By now you've surely had the best of the ice in Sisti Vampiri, those of them who were readily got at anyway. So what use to persist?"
Scheiton had cocked his cobra head to one side, coiled up his arms, and inquired,
"And have you fathomed it at all, my son? Do you know the precise use to which they're put, these things of mine?"
"Certainly. They are variations on a theme, ingurgitators not unlike that of those which stopped Vuls and Arcus, but rather more specialized. Their slender bone-tipped cartilage snouts vibrate in ice to shatter it, whereby paths are drilled to the suspended exiles in their otherwise impenetrable sheaths. Once a channel has been cut, then the beast drains off its victim's liquids through its snout, which siphoned fluids
are then regurgitated into my reservoirs."
Scheiton, perhaps peeved with Scythus's ingenuity, had finished it for him.
"Yes, yes, but aren't you curious to know how? How may the driller siphon off solids, eh? For, of course, his victims are mainly frozen, whose fluids gurgle like glue."
"Ah!"
Scythus had been fascinated.
"I will explain, in a moment, as to why I bother myself with these old lords, when, as you pointed out, they're now so few in number and invariably low in sustenance. The answer to that is simple, because it pleases me to do so. The terror in the minds of those of them who can still think at all is so rare and delicious as to be exquisite. If I had not them, then whom would I terrify, eh? Could I even exist without my measure of tyranny and terror?"
And Scythus had understood. Evil feeds on terror. Without one, the other cannot exist. They are inseparable as space and time. And reading his thoughts, Scheiton had whisperingly, gurglingly, chortlingly agreed.
"Aye, it's as simple as that. I like it, and I need the practice."
So that was why, and the how of it was likewise simple. The drillers squirted metamorphic acids into their victims, whose desiccated tissues had dissolved into liquids which were drawn off before they could re-solidify.
"It still doesn't answer my first question,"
Scythus had argued.
"Which was?"
"Why do you trouble to make more of these creatures?"
Shaitan's shrug of sorts.
"I say again, mainly for the practice.
as has been almost everything I've done these last 3,000 years.
Practice, yes, towards the time when we shall build an army of warriors, and with them set out against Starside and all the worlds beyond."
For a moment the scarlet eyes beneath the fallen one's cobra hood had burned more brightly yet, like fires stoked from within. But then he nodded, gradually returned from the privacy of his dark-cloaked thoughts, and said,
"Ah, but for now, you must tell me, since you seem of the opinion that I breed too many, just how many of my ice-drillers and kindred creatures have you seen?"
Scythus had been taken aback. He'd imagined a great many such beasts, to be sure, but what evidence he'd seen of them in the looted ice-castles had been the slow work of countless centuries, in no way the concerted effort of a handful of auroral periods, nor even entire cycles of such. And while here in the workshops at the roots of the volcano several vats steamed and bubbled where Shaitan's experiments continued to shape, still there were precious few working beasts. No flaccid siphoneers here as in Starside's Eyries, for the cone's caldera contained a small lake of water, nor any great requirements for gas beasts, where several of the volcano caverns, especially Shaitan's living quarters, were warmed by active blowholes, so that after giving the question some little thought, Scythus had been obliged to answer,
"Now that I think of it, I can't say I've actually seen any, except this one cooking in its vat."
"Exactly, for there are none. Not of the visible, mobile and eating their heads off varieties, at any rate. I keep only my ingurgitators for the protection they afford me. Now come,"
and Shaitan had taken his descendant down to black, lightless nether caverns, where every niche, crevice and extinct volcano vent served as a storage chamber for the ice-encased progeny of his experimental vats. And there he inquired of him,
"So advise me, how would you keep such as these both awake and full-bellied?"
And answered himself,
"Out of the question. What, in these almost barren icelands, you wouldn't? Which is why, as their various purposes are served, I freeze them into immobility down here. And here they stay, inert for the moment, the raw materiel of tomorrow's army. And when I require another, perhaps different sort of creature, why, I simply design and construct one. The art of the metamorphism, Scythus. But nothing wasted, my son, never that."
Continuing to gaze down on his ancestor's perceived experiments, Scythus had nodded.
"I see you've tried a warrior or two," he'd commented. "Fearsome but archaic. Perhaps I should advise you. Starside's warriors have come a long way since your day. In all truth, these things of yours would not last long against certain of my constructs."
If Shaitan was offended, it hardly showed.
"Then by all means instruct me in these superior metamorphic skills," he answered. "Indeed, and in order that you may do so, you shall have complete freedom of my workshops, materials and vats,"
which had been much to Scythus's liking. Another time Scythus had asked,
"What of your ingurgitators? Since plainly they are working beasts, and since it's your habit to separate them from what they take from their victims, how do you sustain them? And what do you feed them? For as you yourself have pointed out, these icelands are very nearly barren."
Shaitan had then shown him his reservoirs of frozen blood and minced metamorphic flesh, explaining,
"I have been here a long, long time, my son. And when I first came here, but I quickly learnt what it meant to go hungry. Since when I've made provisions not only for myself but for my creatures, both now and in the dawn of our resurgence."
In blank astonishment, Scythus had gazed upon the rims of literally dozens of potholes of black plasma.
"Blood? So much blood! But not from the Frozen Lord, surely? There were never sufficient of the Vampiri in all Starside to fill these great bowls."
"Beast blood," Shaitan told him. "Whale blood, too. Yes, and even a little man blood. But you are correct, only a very little of the latter. The blood of beasts and great fishes is fine for my creatures. It will fuel them to war when that time is come. Following which, why, There'll be food aplenty for all, eh? But the man-blood is mine and yours too, now that you're here, for our sustenance.
Scythus had been even more astonished.
You've bled the great fishes in the cold sea?
Actually, while I called them fishes, they are mammals,
Shaitan had shrugged in his fashion.
They're warm-blooded, those giants, and suckle their young. Soon after, I came here and saw a school at play, spouting at the rim of the ocean, so that my first ingurgitator was designed with them in mind. It was a good design, and I've scarcely changed it down the centuries. Doubtless you've noted the vestigial gills, fins, and other seeming anomalies in the volcano's guardian creatures, likewise in my driller.
Scythus had noted those things. Indeed, it was his habit to note everything. On another occasion, fascinated by the sheer age of his self-appointed mentor, Scythus had thought to suggest,
But you have been here upon the earth in Starside and in the Icelands, mainly in these frozen wastes, almost since the beginning.
Even speaking those words, he had realized how naive they must sound and how much in awe of the other he must seem, which his ancestor's dark chuckle had at once confirmed.
The beginning? Oh, no, for I perceive that the world is a million times older than I am. Or did you mean the beginning of the Vampiri? In which case I can but agree, for I was the first of all.
Really?
Asked Scythus. Again Scythus forgot to distance himself from his astonishment. It was hard to be inscrutable in the face of revelations such as these. Of course, the legends of Starside said that Shaitan the Fallen had been the first vampire. But as any fool is aware, legends are like myths, mainly untruths or at best exaggerations.
The first? The father of us all?
The first of the Vampiri, aye,
Shaitan had answered at last, after a long curious silence.
But not the father, did you say?
No, not the father. Oh, I fathered my share, be sure, but I was young with a young man's appetites. I had been a man, entire and fallen to earth here, where my vampire came to me, came out of the swamps.
He paused, leaving his words to taper into a thoughtful silence. And after a while...
Out of the vampire swamps?
Scythus had pressed him.
There are great swamps to the west of Starside, and according to the legends, others in the east. I've heard of such, but never seen them. Are these the swamps of which you speak?
Shaitan was still distanced by strange reverie. Nevertheless, he nodded.
Those are the swamps, aye. I fell to earth in the west.
Scythus had heard him use this term about falling to earth before. Frowning and shaking his head, he'd said,
I fail to understand. How may a man fall to earth? Out of the sky, do you mean? From your mother's womb? But weren't you also called the unborn? Where did you fall from and how?
Shaitan had snapped out of it.
You are a nosy person, and your questions are rude. Still, I'll answer them as best I may. First, understand this, my memories start at the swamps, and even then they are faded and incomplete. Before the swamps, I am not sure. But when I came naked to this world, I came in great pain and great pride. I believe that I was exiled into this place, thrown down here, even as the Vampiri exiled me last to these Icelands. The Vampiri exiled me because I would be the one power. Well, and perhaps I had tried to be a power in the other place, too, wherefrom I was banished and fell to earth. It is a mystery to me, but this I do know. Compared to the other place, this world was like a hell.
Someone had sent you here as a punishment? To a life of hell?
Or a world which could become a hell of my making? It was a question of will. Anything could be if I so willed it or allowed it to be. I repeat, it was because I was willful and prideful that I was here. Or at least, that is how I seem to remember it.
You do not actually remember falling then, only that you were suddenly there in the vampire swamps.
Close to the swamps, yes, where my vampire came into me.
Scythus had been keenly interested in that last.
In our time, he mused, we've both had occasion to kill enemies and tear their living vampires out of them to devour. Fesvarenk and Arcus Leperson were only the most recent. We know what such parasites look like. Fully formed, they are barbed leeches, which hide in men to shape their thoughts and urges, and in certain hosts, over long periods, they may grow so fused to become inseparable.
As in myself, yes, Shaitan had answered. Indeed, there remains precious little of the original me left at all, while my vampire is grown to what you see.
Just so, said Scythus. You, or rather your vampire, as a result of prolonged metamorphism, is now gross. But how was it then? Did it come to you as an egg? Did the parent creature remain in the swamps? Or did the parasite come to you full-grown, take you by surprise, and slither into you complete?
It came to me from the swamp, Shaitan had repeated. That much I know. How, I do not know. The problem had vexed Scythus and his ancestor no less, but on that occasion at least they'd been at a loss for further questions and answers. A good many auroral periods later, however, when Scythus was busy in a corner of the workshop, carefully constructing a warrior for his ancestor's approval, "This is how it was," said Shaitan, coming swiftly and in some excitement upon Scythus where he worked, and flowing up to him like a midnight shadow. "In that early existence of which I appraised you, I served another or others, but desired to serve only myself. As a reward for my pride, which is to say for my wit and great beauty, of which I was perhaps too much aware, and for my pains, I was thrown out and removed from my rightful place in that society. I was not destroyed, not wasted, but used. I became to them a tool, a seed of evil, which they would sow between the spheres. Do you see? I was the folly and the penance. I was the darkness which allows for the light." In the face of this outburst, Scythus had brought his work at the vat to a halt. Unable to understand the other, he could only shake his head and throw up his hands.
"Can't you explain yourself more clearly?"
"Damn you, no," Shaitan had shouted then. "I dreamed it. I know it for truth, but I cannot understand it. I've told it to you so that you also may attempt to fathom it, and likewise fail to fathom it, even as I have failed." With which, and in fury, he had rushed off and disappeared into the volcano's labyrinth. For a long time after that, Scythus had not seen the other at all. He had merely been aware of his ancestor's shadowy presence. But a time had come when, going again to the vats, he'd found the ancient gloomily examining his various adaptions, where they squirmed and hardened in their liquids, and there, following customary greetings, but in answer to no specific remark or query, Shaitan had listlessly mumbled, "I have been banished out of many spheres, and thrown down from many worlds, I, and others like me, throughout all the myriads of cone-shaped dimensions of light. That had been all."
"Mad creature,"
Scythus had kept his thoughts and others, he was thinking very much to himself.
"But it's as well you rush around crazed while I'm about to work. The last thing I would want is for you to become interested in what I'm doing."
For in fact he was there at that time in order to inject brain matter into his new construct, so stimulating and even directing the fetal ganglion's growth. Except these were cells obtained from a rather special source, and by means of Shaitan's ice-boring ingurgitator. Putting all such business aside for the moment, however, and pandering to Shaitan's insanity, if that's what it was, he had answered,
"In which case, when you go against Starside with these warriors I'm fashioning, your revenge will be so much sweeter. Nothing will stand before us, and if there are higher worlds to conquer, they too shall finally fall, even as you fell to earth."
His words had seemed to suffice to draw the other up from whatever morbid depths claimed him, even so far as to correct his temporary imbalance, and, "Indeed, these appear to be good warriors, my son," he'd at once remarked, a rare compliment, at once regulated by, "which they should be. For in Starside you had a sufficiency of superb clay with which to practice." And after that, the ancient rambled no more. Later still, the two had constructed a slender, streamlined, powerful flyer.
equipped it with a sucking snout and given it the stripped-to-basic brain of one of Menor Membite's otherwise defunct lieutenants. Fueling the beast on quality plasma, they'd sent it on a reconnaissance flight to Starside. After that, and over the space of a good many auroral displays, they'd waited on its return, but in vain. Eventually, when almost all hope had faded, the flyer had returned, bringing back with it a scrawny, shivering waif of a traveller child. The flyer had snatched him, a boy of 8 or 9 years, at sundown from a party of travellers where they camped in the hills over Sunside. It appeared that the travellers no longer went to Earth when the sun sank down into night. Why should they, when the Vampiri were no more? But the return journey from Starside had been long, and the child almost dead from exposure. Shaitan had carried him away to his private chambers for questioning. Shortly thereafter, the ancient's mind call had summoned Shaithus from where he worked at the vats.
Come!
A single word, yes, but its author's excitement had spoken volumes.
Chapter 5. Sundown, Exocets, the God Mind. Shaithus stood tall and severe in the black, gapped caldera wall and looked south towards Starside. Overhead, the aurora wove in a sky which was otherwise black, but he knew that on Starside it would be sunup. The mountain peaks would be burning gold, and in Charon's Eyrie, thick curtains and tapestries woven with her sigil would guard the uppermost windows, while lances of sunfire might otherwise strike through. He looked south, narrowing his scarlet eyes to focus upon a far faint line of fire all along the horizon, a narrow golden haze which separated the distant curve of the world first from blue, then black space, where all the stars of night hung glittering and hypnotic, seemed to beckon him. Which was a call he would answer. Soon. Indeed he must, for when the aurora died to a flicker, and the sky in the south darkened to jet, then it would be sundown, in advance of which Shaithus and his devolved, depraved ancestor would muster their warriors, mount their flyers, and launch a small but monstrous army from the volcano's steep lava slopes. For them, the realization of a dream, and for Starside the advent of a nightmare, was finally in the offing. Shaitan's dream, for so many hundreds of years, now looming into being, brought into sharp relief by a lone flyer's recent return out of Starside with its burden of a stolen traveller waif. Shaithus remembered the event in minute detail, the way his gloating ancestor had carried off the exhausted, half-dead boy into the gloom of his sulphur-floored chambers, following which, eventually, his mental summons.
Come!
In his mind's eye, Shaithus saw it all again, the fallen one, jubilant where he paced, or flowed to and fro across the black, grainy floor of his apartments in his excitement. And before Shaithus was able to frame a question,
"This dweller of whom you've spoken," Shaitan had turned to him, "this alien youth who used the power of the sun itself to bring down the mighty Vampiri."
"Yes? What of him?"
"What of him?"
Shaitan had gurgled darkly, delightedly, in his fashion.
"Devolved, that's what. Even as I myself am devolved, but to his far greater cost. So he bathed you all in a blazing sunlight, eh? By which reducing Vampiri flesh to steam and stench. Well, and he seared himself too. His vampire must have been injured. It could not repair itself. His metamorphic man-flesh sloughed away even as a leper's. Then his desperate vampire returned him to an earlier form, that of its original host and manifestation. Less bulk in that, making the wastage easier to contain, do you see? And so your dweller is now a wolf."
"A wolf?"
Astonished, Shaithus had remembered his dream.
"A beast, aye, going on all fours, A grey one, the leader of the pack, with nothing of powers except those of the wild. The travellers hold him in awe, whose four paws are human hands. A little of his mind must be human, too, at least in its memories. And of course his vampire has survived, in however small part, for that was what saved him. But the rest is wolf.
A wolf?
Scythus had breathed it again. Well, it wasn't the first time he'd experienced oniromatic dreams. It was an art of the vampiri, that's all.
And his father, the Helllander Harry Keogh?
He is back in Starside, aye.
Back?
Indeed. For following the Battle of the Dweller's Garden, he returned to his own place. Something which you could hardly be expected to know, for by then you were in exile.
His own place? The Helllands?
Helllands? Helllands? They are not Helllands. How often must I tell you? This place is hell, with its sulphur stenches, vampire swamps, and sun-blasted furnace lands beyond the mountains. Aye, but Harry Keogh's world, to the likes of us, it would be paradise.
Well, how can you know that?
I can't, but I can suspect it.
This Harry Keogh,
Scythus had mused,
he had powers, to be sure, but he was not vampiri.
Well, now he is, Shaitan at once contradicted him, but as yet untried.
For who is there to test him?
In devious argument or in battle. What's more, the travellers don't fear him, for he will not take the blood of men.
What?
According to the boy, Shaitan had said, the dweller's father eats only beast flesh. Compared to your vampire, my son, it seems he is a puling, unsophisticated infant of a thing.
And the so-called Lady Karen?
Ah, yes, Shaitan had said. The Lady Karen, last of the Starside's vampiri. You have designs on that one, don't you? I remember you remarked on her treachery, and even now her name falls like acid from your forked tongue. Well, Karen and Harry Keogh are together. So at least he's that much of a man. They share her eyrie. If she's the beauty you say she is, doubtless he's in her to the hilt and beyond, and even as we speak. It was a deliberate jibe, and Scythus knew it, but still he could not resist rising to the other's bait.
Then they should enjoy each other while they can,
he had answered darkly, and finally he had looked around for the traveller child. Gone, Shaitan told him. Man flesh pure and simple. I've had my share of metamorphic mush these thousands of years. The boy was a titbit, but welcome for all that.
The entire child?
In Sunside there are entire tribes, Shaitan had answered, his voice a clotted gurgle. And beyond that, entire worlds. With which they commenced to ready themselves for their resurgence. Now Scythus waited on the emergence of his latest warrior creature, and his ancestor Shaitan the Fallen waited with him. When the beast's scales, grapples, and various fighting appendages had stiffened into chitin hard as iron, a matter of hours now, finally it would be time to venture forth against Starside. As for any future battle, would it even last long enough to qualify as such? Shaitan doubted it, for he firmly believed that on his own, single-handedly controlling a mere fistful of warriors from the back of a flyer and without his ancestors' help, still he could have the measure of Karen and her lover, and whatever allies they might muster, and therefore the measure of Starside too. What? A mere female? A pack of wolves? A vampire lord who shied from man-blood? No army, but a rabble. Let Keogh call up the dead if he would. Fine for scaring trogs and travellers. But Scythus had no fear of the crumbling dead. And as for the other facet of Keogh's magic, that clever trick of his of coming and going at will, invisibly, that wouldn't help him. Not this time.
If he went, good riddance. And if he came, let it be to his death. But on the other hand, Scythus could scarcely deny his own troublesome dreams, whose patterns were strange as the auroral energies which even now wove in the sky high overhead. Perhaps he should examine those dreams yet again, as so often before, except no time, not now, for he felt a familiar encroachment and knew that Shaitan was near, in mind if not in body, and—
"What is it?"
he inquired.
"How clever you are," the other purred, telepathically, "and oh so sensitive. There's no sneaking up on you, my son."
"Then why do you persist in trying?"
Scythus was cold. Shaitan ignored his testiness and said,
"You should come now. Our creatures are mewling in their vats and would be up and about. They must be tested. You have things to do, preparations to make."
Indeed, it was true enough, and—
"I shall be there immediately,"
Scythus answered, commencing the treacherous climb down from the cone. Yes, for his ancestors weren't alone in his eagerness to be free of this place. Except there's freedom and there's freedom, and the concept is never the same to any two creatures. Shaitan would merely free himself from the Icelands, while his descendant, he had something else to be free of. Some little time earlier, and several thousands of miles to the south, the Necroscope had been out to inspect Karen's advance guard. Her early warning system of specialized warrior creatures, or rogue troops as they seemed to have become, where she'd stationed them at the rim of the frozen sea against any incursion from the Icelands. He had gone there via the Mobius Continuum in a series of 100-mile jumps, which had taken him far across consecutive northern horizons into aurora-litten wastes, where the snow lay in great white drifts on the shores of a sullenly heaving, ice-crusted ocean. Karen's creatures had been there sure enough, and Harry was soon to discover how well they'd adapted. Metamorphic? A single generation had sufficed to accelerate their evolution. They'd grown thick white fur, both for protection against the cold and as a natural camouflage. When Harry had thought to detect some slight movement in a humped snowfield, and after he'd carefully moved a little closer, then he'd seen just how effective the latter device was. His first real awareness of the beasts had been when three of them reared up and charged him, in combination a quarter acre of murder running rampant. Then, removing himself some small distance, he thought, "I'd be little more than a minnow to be divided between three great cats. They'd get no more than a taste apiece. But note their instinctive tendency to secrecy," Karen had commented from her eyrie some 3,000 miles south. "Their minds may be feeble, but still they are able to hide their thoughts, and thus themselves, away from you. What's more, you are Vampiri, a lord, a master, but that didn't stop them either." The Necroscope had detected a degree of pride in Karen's thoughts. These were her creatures, and she'd made a good job of them. Alas, but then she'd allowed them to slip the leash. Still focusing on him, she had detected that thought too.
"The distance was too great," she said with a shrug. "I see that now. Telepathy is a special talent which we share. Our mainly human minds are large, and we focus them well, wherefore contact between us is simple. But their minds are small and mainly concerned with survival."
Again her shrug.
"Quite simply, they've forgotten me."
"Time they remembered then," Harry had answered, and as she amplified and reinforced her original orders and instructions, so he'd relayed them directly and forcefully into the group's dull minds, following which, and when he went among them a second time, they'd behaved with more respect.
"Brave of you," she commented, however nervously, "to examine them at such close quarters, and perhaps a little foolish too. Come out of there, Harry, please. Come home now."
Home. Did she mean back to the eyrie, he wondered? And was that really his home now? Perhaps it was in keeping that monstrous many a rising over Starside's boulder plains, whose furnishings were fashioned from the hair and fur, gristle and bones of once men and monsters,
What better home for a man whose lifelong friend had been the Grim Reaper himself? Bitter thoughts, but on the other hand, it had seemed to Harry that Karen pleaded with him, and that she was concerned for him, and any home was better than none. Anyway, his job was finished here now, and he was cold, but he knew that Karen would warm him. A Universe Away in the Urals. Major Alexei Bizanov was present in the Perchovsk core for the latest computer-simulated test-firing of the Tokarevs, his 2IC. Captain Igor Kripo was in charge of the test. Kripo was short, sharp-featured, with the dark eyes and weather-worn complexion of his stepman ancestors. Throughout his preparations, the officer had kept up a running commentary for the benefit of the half-dozen junior officers in attendance. Also in attendance and keeping a close eye on the proceedings from where he stood apart on the perimeter walkway under the inward curving arch of the granite wall, Project Director Viktor Luchov was quietly intense, totally absorbed in Kripo's instructive monologue as it approached its climax.
"Two missiles, yes," Kripo continued. "A dual system. In the field, their launching would constitute either a preemptive strike in a hitherto non-nuclear battle zone or retaliation against an enemy's use of similar weapons. The first, Tokarev, would seek out enemy HQ somewhere beyond the forward edge of the battle area, and the second would home in on heavy enemy troop concentrations in the battle zone. For our purposes, however, here in Perchovsk," Kripo shrugged, "while our targets are somewhat more specific, they remain paradoxically conjectural. We aim to detonate the first missile in a world beyond this, gate."
With a cursory wave of his hand, he indicated the glaring white sphere behind him.
"And the second, Tokarev, while it is still inside the passage between universes. The mechanics of the thing are very simple. Onboard computers are linked by radio. As the first Tokarev clears the gate into the far world, contact will be broken. 1/5 of a second later, both devices will detonate."
Captain Kripo sighed and nodded.
"As for the purpose of this system, if and when used, it will be entirely defensive. You've all been shown films of creatures from the other side breaking through into this world. I'm sure I don't have to stress how important it is that in future no further emergencies be allowed. Lastly, and before the simulation, there remains the question of command and personal security. Command, these weapons will only be used on the instructions of the project director as qualified by the officer commanding, Major Bizanov, or, in the unlikely event of his absence, by me, except under circumstances where a chain of command situation has been initiated, no other person will have that authority. Personal security. From the moment the button is pressed, the warheads are armed. There will be a delay of 5 minutes before firing. Anyone who remains in Perchovsk at that time will be alerted by continuous klaxons. The klaxons have only one meaning. Get out.
Exhaust from the Tokarevs is toxic.
As a safety measure against the unlikely failure of the project's ventilation systems, any stragglers will need to employ breathing apparatus until they've exited the complex. It takes about 4 minutes for a fit man to make it out of here from the core into the ravine. These Tokarevs are weapons. Their use will not be experimental, but for effect. There is no failsafe. After firing, the system cannot be aborted, and we cannot rely on more than 60 seconds before detonation, which makes a total of 6 minutes after initiation. The explosion of the device on the far side should have no effect here. But the one in the passage may be different. It could be that the sheer power of the detonation will drive radioactive gases and debris back through into Perchovsk. Hopefully, all such poisons will be contained down here in the vicinity of the core, by which time the place will have been vacated and the exit sealed.
Pripo straightened up and put his hands on his hips.
Any questions?
There were none.
Simulation is computerized.
He relaxed, scratching his nose and offering an apologetic shrug.
Bit of a letdown, I'm afraid, if you were expecting a fireworks show. Instead, it will all happen on the small screen there in black and white, silent and with subtitles, and no special effects.
The audience laughed.
Mainly.
Kripo held up a warning hand to silence them.
This is to let you see how short a span 6 minutes really is.
And he pressed a red button on the box, seated in front of him on top of his lectern. Major Bizanov had seen the simulation before. He wasn't especially interested in that, but he was interested in the expression on Viktor Luchov's face, one of rapt fascination. Bizanov took 2 paces backwards onto the perimeter walkway, edged up quietly on the gaunt scientist, and coughed quietly in the back of his throat. Luchov turned his head to stare at the major.
You still think this is some kind of game, don't you? He accused.
No, Bizanov answered. I never did.
I know that any order I might give on the use of these weapons is to be qualified by you or your 2IC. Do you suspect I might order their use frivolously, then? Not at all.
The major shook his head, only too well aware of several close-typed, folded sheets of paper where they bulked out his pocket. Luchov's current psychological profile as supplied by the project psychiatrist, and to himself, insanely, yes, but not frivolously. Luchov's eyes were suddenly vacant.
I sometimes feel that I'm being punished, he said.
Oh?
Yes, for my part in all of this, I mean. I helped build the original Perchovsk. In those days, Franz Ivag was the director, but he died in the accident and so paid for his part in it, since when the responsibility has been mine.
A heavy enough load for any man. Bizanov nodded, moved apart a little, and decided to change the subject.
I saw you come up from below, before Kripo started on his demonstration. You were down in the abandoned Magmus levels?
Luchov shuddered and whispered.
God, what a mess things are in down there. So many of them were trapped, sealed in. I opened a cyst. The thing inside, it was like... it was an alien mummy. Not rotten or liquid this time. Just a grotesque mass of inverted, half-fossilized flesh. Several major organs were missing on the outside, along with a good many curious and, I don't know, appendages of rubber, plastic, stone, and etc.
Bizanov felt sorry for him. Luchov had been here too long, but not for much longer. Not if Moscow would act quickly on the major's recommendations.
It is terrible down there, Viktor, he agreed, and it might be best if you kept out of it.
Viktor? And Bizanov's tone of voice. What? Pity? Luchov glanced at him, glared at him, abruptly turned away, and over his shoulder, stridingly,
So long as I am project director, Major, I'll come and go as I will.
And then he made away. Bizanov approached Kripo. By now, the twin dart shapes moving jerkily across the computer screen had popped into oblivion. The simulation was over. Kripo was finishing off.
We'll still be filled with toxic exhaust fumes and could well be highly radioactive, but of course we shall all be well out of it.
The major waited until Kripo had given the dismiss, then took him to one side and talked to him briefly, urgently, about Luchov. The necroscope dreamed. He dreamed of a boy called Harry Keogh, who talked to dead people and was their friend, their one light in otherwise universal darkness. He dreamed of the youth's loves and lives, minds he'd visited, bodies he'd inhabited, places he had known now, in the past and future, and in two worlds. It was a very weird dream and fantastical, more so because it was true, and for all the necroscope dreamed about himself, his own life, Still, it was as if he dreamed of another. Finally, he dreamed of his son, a wolf, except this part was real and not just a memory from another world. And his son came to him, tongue lolling, and said,
"Father, they're coming."
Harry came awake on the instant, slid from Karen's bed, went swift and sinuous to the window embrasure, where he drew aside the drapes. He was wary, kept himself well to one side, was ready to snatch back his hand in a moment, if that should be necessary. But it wasn't, for it was sundown. Shadows crept on the mountain divide, usurping the gold from the peaks. Stars, at first scarcely visible, came more glowingly alive moment by moment. The darkness was here, and more darkness was coming. Karen cried out in her sleep, came awake and jerked bolt upright in the tumbled bed.
"Harry!"
Her face was ghostly pale, a torn sheet with a triangle of holes for each eye and mouth, where she gazed all about the room. But then she saw the necroscope at the window, and the holes of her eyes came burning alive.
"They're coming!"
Their scarlet glances met and joined, formed a two-way channel for thoughts which moments ago were sleeping. Harry saw through Karen's eyes into her mind, but he answered her aloud anyway.
"I know," he said.
She came off the bed naked and flew to him, buried herself in his arms.
"But they're coming," she sobbed.
"Yes, and we'll fight them," he growled, his body reacting of its own accord to the feel and smell of her flesh, which was soft, silky, pliable, ripe, musty, and wet where his member grew into her. She trapped him there with muscles that held him fast, and groaned.
"Let's make this the very best one, Harry."
"Because it might be the last."
"Just in case,"
she grunted, forming barbs within herself to draw him further in. After that, it was like never before, leaving them too exhausted to be afraid. Later, he said, "What if we lose?"
"Lose?"
Karen stood behind him. They leaned together and gazed out through a window in a room facing north, towards the Icelands. As yet, there was nothing to be seen, and they hadn't expected there would be. But they could feel something. It radiated from the north like ripples on a lake of pitch, slow, shuddery, and black with its evil. Harry nodded slowly. "If we lose, they can only kill me," he said, and he thought of Johnny Found and the things he had done to his victims. Terrible things, but compared to Scythers and any other survivors of the old Vampiri, Johnny Found had been a child, and his imagination sadly lacking. Karen knew why the necroscope closed his mind to her, for her own protection, but it was a wasted effort. She knew the Vampiri much better than he did. Nothing Harry was capable of imagining could ever plumb the true depths of Vampiri cruelty. It was Karen's opinion, which was why she promised him,
"If you die, I die."
"Oh? And they'll let you die, will they? So easily?"
"They can't stop me. On this side of the mountains, it is sundown. But beyond Sunside, true death waits there for any vampire. It burns like a molten gold in the sky. That's where I'd flee, far across the mountains into the sun. Let them follow me if they dared, but I wouldn't be afraid. I remember when I was a child and the sun felt good on my skin. I am sure that in the end, before I die, I could make it feel that way again. I would will it to feel that good."
"Morbid," Harry stood up straighter, gave himself a shake. "All of this, morbid. Keep it up and we're defeated before we even begin. There must be at least a chance we'll win. Indeed, there's more than a chance. Can they disappear at will as we can, like ghosts into the Mobius Continuum?"
"No, but..."
"But
wherever we go," she said, "and however many times we escape, we'll always have to return. We can't stay in that place forever."
Her logic was unassailable. Before Harry could find words to answer, perhaps to comfort her or himself, she continued,
"And Scythus is a terrible foe. How devious," she shook her head, "you could scarcely imagine."
"True."
A voice came startlingly from nowhere, entering the minds of both of them.
"Scythus is devious, but his ancestor, Shaitan the Fallen, is worse far."
"The Dweller!"
Karen gasped as she recognized their telepathic visitor, and then incredulously,
"But did you say Shaitan?"
"The fallen one, aye."
The wolf's voice rasped in their minds.
"He lives, he comes, and he, not Shaitas, is the terror."
Harry and Karen reached out with their own telepathy, tried to strengthen the mind bridge between themselves and their visitor, and for a moment the eerie was filled with flowing mental pictures. A mountain slopes where domed boulders projected through sliding scree, of a full moon lending the crags a soft yellow mantle, of great firs standing tall, and in the shadow of trees, silver triangular eyes blinking, a good many, where the pack rested before the hunt. Then the pictures faded and were gone, and likewise the one who lived with them and moved among them. But his warning remained with Karen and the necroscope. How he could know what he had told them, who could say? But he was, or had been, the dweller, and that was enough. Time passed. Sometimes they talked, and at other times they simply waited. There was nothing else to do. This time, seated before a fire in the Eyrie's massive great hall, they talked. "Shaitan is part of my world's legends, too," said Harry. "They called him Satan, the devil, whose place is in hell."
"In Starside's histories, your world was hell," Karen answered, "and all of its dwellers were devils. Dremel Doombody believed it firmly."
Harry shook his head. That the Vampiri, monstrous as they were and still are, should hold with beliefs.